Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about controlling invasive species. You know, it's a never-ending battle. With me in the studio today, Kelly Kearns, back with us once again. Hi, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, she's the invasive plant coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She also works with the Natural Heritage Conservation Program. And also with us today, Mark Renz. Mark, good to see you, too.
Good morning, Larry.
Mark, an associate professor and extension specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So great to have both of them here talking about, well, those invasives that are creating some problems. Maybe you can call in. Are you seeing some things out there that are creating problems for you? I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, and you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, it's a good time to talk about it. June is Invasive Species Action Month, isn't it, Kelly? And we're dedicating a month to it.
Right. Yeah. So in the past, it was Invasive Species Awareness Month, and we've decided to move that to becoming Action Month because a lot of people are aware of invasive species now, and it's time for people to be taking action. And a lot of people are, and we actually had our Invader Crusader Awards ceremony a couple of weeks ago, and we had quite a few winners, mostly volunteers that were nominated, that people working all over the state. We had several good groups that were that won the award. People from Bayfield Peninsula to Two Rivers over to La Crosse. So folks from all over the state that are doing really great work on invasive species.
And June is a good month for this whole business?
June is good because that's when a lot of things are, people are starting noticing that things are flowering. And when things are when plants are flowering, that's the best time to identify them. And that's when people really notice them. And so it's a good time for people to, you know, get outside and start doing some control work.
And what are some of the ways organizations, you know, you mentioned some of the winners, and I'm thinking, I wonder what they did. Or what are they doing to promote the control of invasives or working?
Well, there's been a couple of the groups that that won the Invader Crusaders. One was the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in La Crosse, and they've been doing incredible work on their own property, their 200-acre property there. And there's a group called the Woodland Dunes Barbarians. They're controlling barberry and other species there, doing a lot of invasives control work there. Another group is the Otto Leopold Foundation, which you're probably aware of, up in Baraboo. And they've been doing incredible work with landowners, organizing the My Wisconsin Woods program and getting landowners trained on invasives and doing management work. Then also the Red Cliff Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. Mm-hmm. They had a Phragmites settling pond where they, for a sewage treatment pond, they used Phragmites to dewater the sludge. And the Phragmites that was used at the time back 20 years ago was the non-native Phragmites. And so they've done this extensive cleaning out of their sludge ponds and getting rid of the non-native Phragmites extremely carefully and then replacing it with native Phragmites. Huge project.
Mark, how does a plant get classified as an invader?
Well, that's a great question, Larry, and it's really one that's often confused by a lot of the citizens. So to be an invasive plant, we actually have it in state law. It needs to not be native, so it needs to be a plant that during European settlement was not present in Wisconsin, and it either has to have the potential to cause some type of impact or is causing impact, and that impact can be environmental. Reed canary grass is a great example of that. It can be economic. A good example of that is many of our brush that are impacting our forests and affecting regeneration of our forests. Or it can be an impact to our human health. And there's no greater example than wild parsnip, which if you get the sap on you, can burn you. We have Japanese barberry, which can increase the prevalence of ticks. And with ticks comes, you know what, Lyme disease. So really the key is it's a non-native plant. We have many native plants that we may not like, but we shouldn't call them invasive because they're native, at least during European settlement.
And so if they've been around for decades, even if they're not from here, they're an invader.
Yeah, they're an invader, and they have to have some impact. Another way to look at this is the benefits of them being present in our system does not outweigh the potential risks. I think that's a really good way to look at it with these invasive species, because all the plants will have some sort of benefits. A great example is Dame's Rocket, which is flowering in purple right now, clearly having benefits to pollinators and benefits to us, right? It's beautiful on the landscape.
Really,
but it has some negative impacts. It's thought to actually prep the soil for other invasives to invade into the future. So there's negative impacts. So we got to really weigh those in making those decisions.
Kevin in Madison has a question about Virginia creeper, I think.
Yeah, and so this is like the prime example. So Virginia creeper. Oh, hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say we could do a show on my place. I have 2 acres here in Madison that hadn't been tended to, and I have a ton of buckthorn, honeysuckle, and Virginia creeper that I've been trying to slaughter. But I'm curious to how I should deal with the Virginia creeper.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. And so Virginia creeper, and Kelly, she's really good at correcting me when I make a mistake. But Kelly, correct me if I'm wrong, Virginia creeper is a native species to Wisconsin. No idea why we call it Virginia creeper when it's native, but it is. So we wouldn't call it invasive, but clearly it's a weed, and it's one that often we don't want. So when you say you have a lot of it, how much of it do you have, Kevin?
I mean, I have stuff that's 6 inches around.
Wow.
It's invasive. And it's killed some oak trees on this property that I have. So I'm killing as much of it as I can. There's curtains of it in the woods. Tarzan could swing from tree to tree the whole 2 acres.
Yeah. So I'm curious if it actually is Virginia creeper. It might be wild grape, I think, is what Kelly's nodding her head. But regardless, what I would have you do is send a picture in to me. You can simply email it to me at MRENZ@WISC.edu, or drop it off your local extension agent or DNR representative. Let's make sure we get it identified. We do have some management recommendations for woody species in general. If there's just one or two, we often just say hand pull it, get rid of it. But when it's a lot of them, we have to go to some more extreme measures. But I think the first step is to get it identified, Kevin.
All right, there we go. And what's your email again?
MRENZ@WISC.edu. And when I don't know what it is, I'll just send it to Kelly and she can identify it.
Yeah, folks can also send photos or questions about invasives to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov. And that's for any invasives. People can send something there and then it will get it off to whoever can identify it.
And we've got lots of things up that you've given us, Kelly, I think, that and Mark, as a matter of fact, that we have in our program notes too, some of the, you know, the various invasives like Canada thistle, for example, and some of the controls. So that's another place you can go. There's an invasive species calendar quick guide, Kelly, that I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's actually put out by some of Mark's staff. It's a new phenology guide.
Yeah. It's by the Wisconsin First Detectors Network, which is a group that empowers and educates citizens to engage people, teaches them about invasive species. And this phenology guide is really neat. So we get lots of questions, I'm sure Kelly does too, about, well, what's flowering now, or what can I go out and identify? And so this is a really interactive tool that allows you to say, I'm going to be visiting the forests, and it's this month, what's flowering and what can I be looking for? And so what we're, again, trying to do is empower people to identify new invasive species that they may see and report them. And this is just a tool that we've gotten feedback from a lot of our colleagues that's really useful. So now if you would go, let's test each other. How many plants would be flowering now? We'd have garlic mustard just finished, Dame's Rocket, leafy spurge.
Yellow sweet clover. Wild chervil just started.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's some of the shrubs. Right. All right, so there's a lot right now.
But you can find all those on that guide.
Yep, and going to the Wisconsin First Detectors Network, if you just Google that, there's lots of other resources. We have fact sheets, videos, and links to other information about that. So it's a really great resource that's there to help people, engage them to identify new invasive plants, and to let us know where they are. I mean, we've actually I looked this up, Kelly doesn't know this, but over the last decade, we've really been promoting reporting invasive species. And do you know, Kelly, we have over 200,000 reports.
Wow, that's
double
great.
Over the last 5 years in Wisconsin. It may sound grim, but we still have a lot of prime areas, and we need to know those locations so we can develop a plan in order to manage them in an appropriate manner.
Yeah. Right.
And one of the other things that's on that website is the what's called a WISTIP viewer, and it actually takes that data of all those reports that have been submitted either by individuals or through any of the online efforts and develop, and it's part of what we call the Invasive Species Archive. And this WISTIP viewer that's on that First Detectors Network page, you can actually look and see where things have been reported in what counties and how frequently and when it's actually gotten reported. So it's a really handy thing if people want to see like what's in their county, what's in their area.
Very cool. Let's take another call. Arlene in Burlington, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry, and yes. I have a question about watercress. I have found a wonderful source for it, love it, and was told by my son-in-law that it is an invasive species. I would get fined and if I ever tried to transport it or plant it someplace else. I looked it up. It says it is invasive. But I don't want anybody to come and kill my whole great big source for it now.
Okay. Well, yes, it is invasive, and it's a really interesting species because it seems to be invasive in springs. And how it gets there is a bit of a mystery because springs are pretty isolated. They tend to be at the headwaters of a stream. And so we think they must probably get moved around by birds that hang out in springs. And it's a mustard, and you know, as you can see, when you're at a site that has watercress, it really dominates the site. It completely can cover over the open water in a spring. And so, yes, it is invasive. However, it is not regulated at this time. There's really not much we can do about minimizing the spread of this. It's pretty much in most of the springs and most of the habitat that's good quality for it. And so we have not regulated this in any way. And so
you're not going to get fine. Thrown in jail, Arlene, holding on to your secret about where the watercress is.
Yes, but for the restricted and prohibited species, yes, that is true that you are not supposed to transport it. We don't want people moving those seeds around or plant parts around and starting new populations.
There you go, Arlene. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about invasive species today with our two guests, Kelly Kearns from the Department of Natural Resources, Mark Renz from the UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking invasive species today with our two guests, Kelly Kearns from the DNR, Mark Renz from the UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions for them, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mimi in Reedsburg emailed to ask what she can do about wild parsnips now that she's given up. She doesn't want to use Roundup. She's 75 years old, can't dig it up. So what the heck do you do?
Yeah, there's a range of options on wild parsnip. It's actually a relatively easy plant to control, but people don't like controlling it because it's growing in areas we usually don't manage that vegetation. And if you get the sap on your skin, it can cause a really bad burn. So there is some physical injury potential. I'd recommend, Mimi, that you look up a fact sheet that we have on wild parsnip. If you just Google wild parsnip and Extension or Wisconsin, it'll pop right up. We have a range of control options. They're sensitive to a range of our common herbicides that could be used. It sounds like you don't want to do any mechanical methods. You can simply sever the root with a shovel and not have to dig it up. You could repeatedly mow it, and that's also effective as well. The key is you can't let it go to seed, and you need to repeat that for 3 to 4 years. If you can repeat that for 3 to 4 years, however you manage it, that population will go away if, and here's the big if that people forget about, no seed is coming into that area
from someplace else.
From someplace else. So you see our roadsides where they're mowing it.
Yeah.
But if you look on the backslope of those roadsides, do they mow those backslopes? No. And there's wild parsnip there that's producing seed and going back into those front slopes. And so that's what's making it a challenge.
Let's go to Gary in Merrill next. Hi, Gary. Gary, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Gary. Gary, are you there? No, I guess we lost him. So let's go to Becky in Rio then. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I had a really bad infestation of field bindweed. Is that actually an invasive plant on the invasive list, or is it just a noxious weed that's hard to get rid of?
Well, that's a good point that it is actually a noxious weed. It's one of our three plants statewide that's regulated as a noxious weed, meaning that the local weed commissioner can require that people control it. However, most municipalities don't have a weed commissioner, and so it's hard for that to actually be done. We do not have it on the regulated restricted invasive species list because it's primarily an agricultural weed and a weed of like lawns and places like that, not really as much of an environmental weed.
So we control it anyway, or
yeah, I mean it's considered a very problematic in many ag situations, and in some natural areas it can dominate. So Becky, again, we have a fact sheet on this bindweed and management options. If you just Google it, it's at the UWEX Learning Store. If you're familiar with that, just type in bindweed and you can get access to that. And there's lots of control options. The bad news is it's really hard to control. What you see growing above ground, that's probably only 10% of the biomass of the plant. So anything you do, you're going to have lots of that plant recovering for many, many years to come. So it really is a challenge.
Thanks, Becky. Bob and Poinette, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I live a little bit north of Poinette. In the area I live along Highway 51, there's a shrub that has popped up and all over the place. It's either called Russian olive or autumn olive or something like that. Are you familiar with that? Because it has taken over like all the properties around here.
Kelly?
Yeah, both Russian and autumn olive are regulated restricted invasive species in Wisconsin. And Russian olive has been planted as an ornamental in the past, which is kind of odd because it turns into this really ugly, scraggly tree. And we don't see it spreading as much in Wisconsin as it does in the states much further west. Autumn olive tends to be much more aggressive here, and autumn olive is more of a shrub. It only gets up into the 10, 12-foot height, whereas the Russian olive is actually a tree. And so if you're seeing ones that appear to be more shrub-like, that's probably autumn olive.
And what about controlling it then?
Well, as with the other woody species, this is one that most people do the control by cutting them off and then doing a cut stump treatment on that cut stump.
Bob, does that help?
Yeah, it does. It's if you drive north on Highway 51 north of Poinette, it's just all over the place because one of the neighbors brought it in, as you said, as like cover for wildlife, but it has taken over everything.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, Bob, and we also have a fact sheet on that highlights and describes this cut stump technique and all other options. As Kelly mentioned, the bad news is all of the management options are really labor intensive. And so whoever recommended that we plant autumn olive, shame on them 50, 75 years ago, because we're going to be battling it for eternity now.
And unfortunately, the birds move those seeds around because the fruits are actually pretty tasty to them probably.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. We turn to Sarah next in Cross Plains. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I've got some invasive honeysuckle in the bushes, and I'm just wondering how to get rid of them. Is it possible for me to dig them out? Are the roots super deep, and does it spread by roots? Where if you cut the root, two more come up?
Yeah.
So, Sarah, a great question. So it does not spread by roots, but it does have like a root crown. And in my experience, compared to other shrubs, it's actually fairly shallowly rooted. So depending on how big it is, you can pull it out. There is this tool called a weed wrench. So imagine a crescent wrench that's 3 to 4 feet tall and is a big leverage tool. You can attach it to the base and pull it out with that mechanism, or you can like attach a chain or rope to it and pull it out with a vehicle. It's relatively easy to get out, and the key is as long as you get that root crown out, that one plant will not resprout from it. So that's the good news. The bad news is if you have hundreds of them, like many of our forests do, that's still a lot of work.
Is that, what's it called again, that wrench?
Well, the trademark is Weed Wrench, but now there's several different name brands that you can purchase. It's basically a leverage tool that attaches to the base and allows you to pull it out. I don't know, Kelly, are you familiar with some of the
Weed
names?
Wrench itself went out of business a while ago and got bought out by one called Polar Bear. But there's a number of these different leverage tools. So you can just look up leverage tools for removing shrubs, and there's a number of them out there.
I wonder if like some of these rental places, if you can just simply rent them. Have you ever seen them that way?
So I
haven't. What do they sell for?
We purchased a 2-foot and a 4-foot one, and I want to say the 2-foot one was like $40, and then the 4-foot one was like $150. So, I mean, they're not chump change.
And there's also a 6-foot.
Yeah.
But they're pretty heavy to carry around in the woods.
Yeah. So there you go, Sarah. Thank you so much for calling. Mark in Green Bay has a question for us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I've got a question about the Phragmites spraying program that took place on the Bay of Green Bay and adjacent waters back in 2000 to 2013. And they got overzealous. I mean, they sprayed 120 miles of shoreline. They defoliated 4,000 acres, used a broad-spectrum, long-lasting herbicide, and now we're reaping the whirlwind of not having any kind of a Phragmites buffer along the shoreline, so the shoreline erosion is just going nuts with the higher waters in Lake Michigan. There's no responsibility. No one takes, they take credit when they spray it, but when there's negative results of their spraying program, no one's there to step up and say, oops, we screwed up.
Mm. Well, Kelly?
Yeah, I haven't been directly involved with that project at all. It's actually one that's been funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is some federal funding. And there's actually a number of different organizations that have been doing it, some folks in DNR and more local groups as well. And I think it would be best probably to talk to some of those folks directly that have been involved in doing it. Yeah, I have not heard about the erosion results from that, but I haven't been involved with that enough to really know what the results have been.
Yeah, I suppose with the high waters we've got now, that could certainly, well, as Mark says, it's creating some problems. So.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's creating shoreline problems all over.
Yeah. So, Mark, go ahead and get it. And who's the place to go?
Well, at the Green Bay office of DNR, they could contact, would be a good one. And then the Bay Lakes Regional Planning Commission is also doing a lot of the work.
Okay. Mark, thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to Steve in Edgerton next. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. It used to be that you could put water systems in ponds, garden ponds, and even bigger ponds, and they did a really great job of filtering the water. And I understand you can't buy that in Wisconsin anymore. Can you not have it at all? Is it completely banned from any watersheds? I have a completely private lined, you know, pond lake that I'm trying to get my water management under control with. And that would have been a great one if it was available. Do you have any other recommendations?
Water hyacinth, that was.
Right. Yes, water hyacinth is no longer allowed in Wisconsin. Part of the problem is that, kind of like goldfish, a lot of people can't just let them freeze out in the winter, and so they want to pick them up and move them to some place where they might stay alive all over the winter. And so we found a number of sites where people have moved them from their private pond into the Mississippi River and some other sites, other lakes and other places. And we have seen evidence of their overwintering. And initially, we didn't think they would have the ability to overwinter, but they reproduce in several different ways. And we have seen some of that evidence in several places. So, yes, they are no longer allowed at all in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good floating natives that can replace that. I would recommend using some of the emergent plants that you can get, some cattails or some other of the emergents. We don't really have anything similar to water hyacinth that's native here.
Oh, so that's too bad. Other emergents? Can you think of another one off the top of your head?
Well, burrweed, some of the rushes, sedges.
Okay.
There's a number of them.
Okay. There you go, Steve. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Dave in Lodi next. Hi, Dave.
Oh, yes. This is related but unrelated. I was wondering if there's such thing as like a invasive cookbook.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them out there. If you Google it, then you'll find several. They have all sorts of different names, but most of them are kind of like self-published, but I've seen at least three or four of them.
Yeah, so go online and take a look. You're going to find one, Dave.
Yeah, if you look on any of the invasive, any of the wild edible plant websites, you'll see a lot of invasive plants that are in there. And a lot of them were actually brought over from Europe or Asia because they were edible, and then they escaped.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
And Kelly, you're gonna write an invasive cookbook when you retire, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I know you're an aficionado on eating invasives, correct?
I do eat invasives a lot, but there's already recipes out there.
What do you eat?
Oh, Japanese knotweed. You can use it early on when it just sends its stalk up, and you use it, cook it like rhubarb, and use it as rhubarb. Garlic mustard, of course, can be used as pesto or as a cooked green. The non-native cattails, the tops of those, the male flower spike, is you cook it like corn. You just steam it and put butter on it, and it's really good. So there's a lot of stuff out there.
Paul in Durand will go to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hey, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. I had a kind of a tangent question to the discussion here. You know, we're talking about invasive species in the state. I'm wondering what invasive species from Wisconsin or North America make their way around the world, and, you know, how maybe other places have to deal with us as a problem, which, you know, is kind of a different way to think of it. But, you know, we're transplanting stuff all over the world, and I'm just kind of curious, really.
Yeah, that's a good, interesting question, Paul. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, Paul, really good question, and it's actually a really big issue. I'll give you a very specific example in Europe. So we have two native, they're agricultural weeds that are not native and are spreading in France and Europe and just causing millions upon billions of dollars of damage. And that damage is in the form of allergies. So it's common and giant ragweed are invasive species to Europe.
Oh.
They're native to Wisconsin, and they've been introduced there and are causing, just wreaking havoc with the public safety and health. With allergies. And so that's two very clear examples of native plants to Wisconsin and the U.S. that are now invading Europe. I'm sure Kelly might have some other examples, but that one sticks in my head because no one likes allergies.
Why the heck would anybody want to transport something like that?
Well, so those probably could have been moved in some of our agricultural supplies years ago.
Oh.
And so they were a contaminant in maybe seeds or feed or something. That's the most likely cause of how we got the European ones in there. And that's my guess how they got over there. I'm not certain, but it's a huge problem. And France, I know specifically, is trying to eradicate it. And my last time I looked at it, they're failing pretty miserably because it's a difficult plant to control.
Yeah, our black cherry tree is a problem in the forest in Central Europe. Canada goldenrod, which can be pretty aggressive here, can be very aggressive over there. Gray squirrels. Our native gray squirrel is problematic over there. So there are a number of species that are certainly problematic. But probably the scale is quite different because when North America was founded, a lot of the people that came over didn't know what to expect, and so they brought their plants with them, you know, wanting to make sure that they had their herbal plants and their food plants. And so a lot of plants got transported to North America as North America was getting settled. And as the forests were being cleared, then all these non-native plants were in. So we actually have probably a larger percentage of European and Asian plants than they have of ours.
Thanks, Paul. Great question. Let's go to Kate in Brookfield. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. Two questions, and then I'll listen off the air. We have 200 acres in Sheboygan County, and we're fighting garlic mustard, and we've been doing that for a long time, and we had it logged 2 years ago, so now it's really bad. So we're getting bags. We're bagging it. Can we take the bags out of the woods and just leave them in a field, the black bags, and let the sun take care of it and burn it in the spring? And then second question about Dame's Rocket, can I pull it and just leave it and have it disposed that way?
Yeah, so great question on both of those. And we get this question this time of the year all the time. It really depends on at what stage of development the plants are when you pull it. We've actually been doing some of this work in our lab with garlic mustard. So as a rule of thumb, what we tell people is if it has flowers on it, There's the potential if you pull a plant and let it sit there, those flowers will turn into seed, and that seed, some of that seed will be viable. The reality is very, very little of that seed will be viable if you pull it when it's flowers on there. And so I think as a rule of thumb, I tell people if you start to see any of those fruit pods, they're called salix, on either of those plants, definitely then is when you want to be concerned and you want to try and bag it. So I think your strategy of putting it in a bag and taking it to a controlled area where you can either burn it or manage it or just monitor to see if any of the plants regrow is a great strategy. An alternative strategy is you can actually put it in the landfill, put a note on the bag saying invasives, and they will take it to the dump and bury it, and they manage for invasives in those landfills as well. So either of those options are really well good. The big problem is some species, we can actually let those fruit turn green before the seeds get viable, while others, the moment it flowers, we need to manage it. So it's very, very species specific, and that's the challenge with this this question.
But those black bags, if you leave them out in the sun, that's going to burn them up, you think?
In theory, I would, you know, my big thing is put them in a controlled area and monitor them.
Okay.
You know, go back to those. If they're all in one area, you can easily go back and burn it, hand pull it. If a bunch of seeds come out, spray it with a herbicide, do something. But if you leave them all out in the field, then they have the potential to reseed and cause that infestation to continue.
We do know that any that garlic, mustard, buckthorn, and other plants that are put into a well-managed compost facility where they actually get the temperatures up high enough on a regular basis and they're turned regularly, those seeds will die from that compost. But in the typical home compost, your temperatures just are not going to get that high.
Yeah.
And so you doing it at a home level is probably not going to work.
There you go, Kate. Thank you so much for calling. Kara in Finland, Minnesota. We'll go to you now. Hi, Kara.
Hi there. I don't have a question so much as a comment. I'm a beekeeper, and I'm originally from Wisconsin, and so I shop a lot in Wisconsin, but I live in Minnesota. And I went to a local feed store and to buy clover for my bees, and I bought the little white clover, but I also bought yellow clover because I heard that the bees love it. And so I'm like, great, go home. And right before I went to put it out, I thought, I should look this up. And I looked it up, and here in Minnesota, it's considered invasive, but not in Wisconsin. Even though I see it along the road, you know, the roadways a lot in Minnesota, it's still considered invasive. So I wanted to take back and ask if they could take it back because I didn't want to plant it on my land.
Yeah.
So is this yellow sweet clover or is it bird's foot trefoil?
Yellow sweet clover.
Okay, yellow sweet clover is invasive in Wisconsin. We have a number of species that are invasive, but they're not regulated. And in part, this one is not regulated because beekeepers and others are really fighting to keep it unregulated. They're concerned that it would be taken away and they wouldn't be able to have it on the landscape as much anymore. It is a species that we would like for people not to buy it and not to move it around and plant it because it's primarily a problem in grassland areas and moves from roadsides into other grasslands. It's certainly a problem in prairies.
Damn, there you go. Thank you, Kara, for calling. Appreciate it. We have Marianne, an email from Marianne, who asks if autumn Russian olive is the same thing as glossy buckthorn.
No, autumn and Russian olive are two separate plants. They're both considered olives, although they're not true olives. The Russian olive is the one we talked about earlier. That's got silvery leaves and is a scrubby tree. And the autumn olive is more of a shrub. And glossy buckthorn is a completely separate species, and it's more related to the common buckthorn, which many people are familiar with. And glossy buckthorn tends to grow more in wetter areas. But all four of those are regulated invasive species.
You mentioned buckthorn. Jennifer emailed that last Saturday, almost 20 people in Junction Ridge worked to eliminate invasive plants in their city-owned prairie. They built a buckthorn brush pile, and it was over 35 feet long. Her question is, they very sparingly treated the stumps with chemicals recommended by the city. Some neighborhood residents are strongly opposed to using any chemical herbicides. Where can she find data about the cost of allowing invasive species to spread unchecked?
Yeah, Jennifer, this is a great question. It's something we're trying to address, is there really isn't a clearinghouse of this information. We do know that, particularly with invasive shrubs, it can cost upwards of $1,000 to just control those per acre. So it can be very costly, particularly in our woodland environments and habitats. But it's really difficult to put an economic cost on the impacts of these invasive species. There have been very few species where this has been done to a certain degree. But to my knowledge, there isn't any information available about the economics of buckthorn. Probably the best source, which is related to another woody species, a lot of our honeysuckles. There was some research that came out from Ohio that showed if you had invasive honeysuckles in your forest, it took 20% longer for those forests to regenerate. So if you're a forester Wow. and you're waiting for that paycheck, you don't get a paycheck very often. If you have to wait 20% longer, that's a pretty significant economic impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's something you that you can use, Jennifer. Thanks for that email. Jeff in Baramu emailed that he has a small prairie restoration. It's getting infested with sumac. I'm wondering the best way to control sumac. He doesn't mind using chemicals if he has to.
Yeah, sumac's a tough one, and it's native, but it can be really competitive. I think what I'd recommend is we have a brush management in Wisconsin fact sheet. If you can look that up, I know we do have sumac on there. There's a range of herbicides available. My recommendation would probably be to look at a cut stump treatment where you cut the stump or the stem, and then you immediately apply herbicide to that cut surface. And I know others in prairie situations have done that and had very good success. It's taken them 2 to 3 years, but they've essentially got them under control, Kelly.
Well, and certainly people use fire in prairie situations, and that'll knock it back. It won't kill it because it has a pretty substantial root system, but the fire will knock it back repeatedly if you do it repeatedly. And one thing that's important to know about sumac is that it spreads clonally, and so that all of those stems are joined in by the same root system, and so they'll just repop up in back up in many places when you do control without using the herbicide.
No. Steve in Lake Geneva, hello to you.
Yes, hi there. We have about an acre and a half of property, and I managed to get rid of a lot of buckthorn and honeysuckle using the cut stump method with about 50% glyphosate applied in the fall. And one thing I found is that both plants burn really well. So anyone who wants to create a bonfire, it's phenomenal and really clean, too. But I had a question regarding getting rid of three herbaceous plants or species. One is the Asiatic dayflower, Bishop's weed. The other is Bishop's weed or what's known as gout weed, and then yellow nutsedge. I've been battling Bishop's weed in all kinds of capacities for some time, and I mean, it's super tenacious. I'm not sure what protocol would be best for getting rid of it, or just planting plants that will exceed its height, which can get pretty high, you know, whether it's a woody species or something, kind of smother it. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't sound too great. The other thing is I noticed that with respect to Bishop's weed, gout weed, and Asiatic dayflower, some people have planted those and they have escaped cultivation, which is interesting, but I was just curious.
Yeah. All right, Mark?
Yeah, so the Asiatic dayflower is an annual, and so I've had success. It was in when I purchased my house 13, 14 years ago, it was in my flower beds, and I think just religious hand pulling or treating and not letting those plants go to flower. And I've gone where I've had seeds of it that occasionally I see 1 to 2 plants. And so I think that one's – you just can't let it go to seed. So once you see a flower, you got to get on top of it and get rid of it. There's a range of options that you could do depending on how much you have. That's the easy one. The other two are the hard ones, particularly Bishop's gout weed. So, Steve, is this in like a flower bed or is this in a forest or where is it?
Yeah, in our backyard on the south side is in kind of like a forested area, which we're trying to – introduce more native plants to.
Yeah, and so this is really a struggle. I actually also had this plant in my yard, but it was in a like 1 square meter area. So what I did is I dug up a foot of the soil deep down, sifted all the soil, took all the roots out, and then put the soil back in. And it worked really well. But it's really, really hard to control this if you don't have a very confined infestation like that. So I think in this case, we typically recommend herbicides. The challenge is trying to figure out which herbicides you can use in your area so you don't damage those desirable plants. Glyphosate is one option. Triclopyr-based herbicides are another option, but you need to look around and see what desirable plants are there and how you can treat those without treating the other ones. And it's going to be a long-term approach. It's really, really competitive because it's a creeping perennial and has these perennial roots.
And finally, you have an invasive species citizen science workshop.
Yeah, and so this is for those of you that have been on the call and you've listened to it, this is our opportunity to, thanks to some work with American Family Insurance, we are this Saturday at American Family Insurance property holding an invasive plant workshop for citizen scientists who's interested in learning how to identify and map invasive species. And so we actually have a smartphone app that allows you to report invasive species. This is a hands-on training. American Family is going to treat us all to lunch, open up their campus where we can walk out there and actually monitor invasive plants on their land. So it's a really neat opportunity that if you're interested, come out. It's going to be from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you're interested, you can contact Ann Pierce, and I will give you her email and her phone number. But it's going to be a wonderful opportunity to get in touch with some like-minded citizen scientists and learn about invasive species and how to map and identify them. So Ann Pierce's email is ANNE.PEARCE. So that's Ann Pierce at WISC.EDU. Mm-hmm. And the phone number is 262-9570. And I'm going to look that up on my phone because I probably just told you the wrong phone number.
It's area 608.
Area code 608. Did I get it right, Larry?
I think you did. 262-9570.
Yeah, I did. Okay, good. Once in my life, I got something right. So
there
it's
you
free,
go.
So please come on out. And again, thanks to American Family Insurance for opening up their property to be a partner in this.
Well, always a pleasure to have you two come by. I appreciate it very much, Kelly and Mark, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much. And I should mention that next week, Wednesday, we talk about aquatic invasives on the show, and Tim Campbell will be coming by to talk about that. So look forward to that as well. Thank you very much. Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plant Coordinator in the Natural Heritage Program with the Wisconsin DNR. Mark Renz, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist at the UW-Madison. And great to have them come by. They come by every so often, and we'll have them back again. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at some art that a project that is, it's a show actually, and it ends this Sunday, but still a chance for you to see it. And the title of the show is Uprooted Plants in a Changing Climate. So what's happening to the plants that we have here due to climate change? And we're looking at the art relating to that next on the Ideas Network.